sheriff, who obviously wanted to escape the other two. A moment later, another elevator appeared, and the two men stepped inside it.
"I've been thinking about what Nettie might have been trying to say," Rolls told him. The doors closed and the elevator smoothly descended.
"I promise you this is crazy."
"I haven't heard anything lately that isn't."
"And you're the man who wrote The Night Watcher."
"Here we go," Don thought. Don buttoned up his coat and followed Rolls outside into the parking lot. Though he wore only his suit, Rolls did not appear to notice the cold.
"Here, get in my car for a second," the editor said.
Don got into the passenger seat and looked over at Rolls, who was rubbing his forehead with one hand. The editor looked much older in the interior of the car. Shadows poured into his wrinkles.
"Glinger, isn't that what she said that last time? You agree? It was a lot like that anyhow, wasn't it? Now, I never knew him myself, but a long time ago, the Denham girls had a brother, and I guess they talked about him for quite a while after he died."
Don drove back toward Milburn on the field-bordered highway under the lurid sky purpled with glowing strips. Back to Milburn, with part of the story of Stringer Dedham riding with him. Back to Milburn, where people were beginning to close themselves up as the snows grew worse and the houses seemed to melt closer together. Where his uncle had died, and his uncle's friends dreamed of horrors. Away from the century and back to the confinement of Milburn. More and more like that of his own mind. Housebreaking, Part 1. 6.
"My father says I'm not supposed to see you so much anymore."
"So what? Do you care? How old are you anyhow, 5?
"Well, he's worried about something. He doesn't look very happy."
"He doesn't look happy," Jim mimicked. "He's old. I mean, what is he, 55? He's got a boring job and an old car, and he's too fat, and his favorite little boy is going to fly out of the nest in 9 or 10 months.
Just take a look around this town, friend. How many folks do you see with big smiles on their wrinkly old faces? This town is loaded with miserable old suckers. Are you going to let them run your life?"
Jim leaned back on his bar stool and smiled at Peter, clearly assuming that the old argument was still persuasive. Peter felt himself sinking back into uncertainty and ambiguity. These arguments were persuasive. His father's worries were not his, and the issue had never been that he did not love his father, for he did, but merely whether he should always obey his father's infrequent orders, or, as Jim put it, "let him run your life." For had he, after all, done anything truly bad with Jim? Because of Jim's keys, they had not even broken into the church. Then they had followed a woman. That was all. Freddie Robinson had died, and that was a shame, even if they had not liked him. But nobody was saying that his death had not been natural. He'd had a heart attack, or had fallen down and hurt his head. And there had been no little boy on top of the station. And there had been no little boy sitting on the gravestone.
"I suppose I should be grateful your old man let you come out tonight."
"No, it's not that bad. He just thinks we ought to spend less time together. Not that we shouldn't spend any time at all together. I guess he doesn't like me sitting in places like this."
"This? What's wrong with this?"
Hardy gestured comically around at the seedy tavern.
"Hey, you! Sunshine!" Jim shouted. "This is a hell of a great place, isn't it?"
The bartender looked back over his shoulder and grimaced stupidly.
"Civilized as shit, Lady Jane. The Duke down there agrees with me."
"I know what your old man is afraid of.
He doesn't want you to get in with the wrong crowd.
Well, I am the wrong crowd.
That's true. But if I am, then so are you. So, the worst has already happened. And as long as you're here, you might as well relax and enjoy it.
If you wrote down the things Hardy said and looked at them afterward, you'd find the errors. But just listening to him talk, you'd be convinced of anything.
See, what the old boys all think is craziness is just another way of staying sane. You live in this town long enough, you're in danger of woodworm in the headboard. And you have to keep reminding yourself that the whole world isn't just one big Millburn.
He looked over at Peter, sipped his beer, and grinned. And Peter saw the fractured light in his eyes and knew, as he had all along, that underneath the staying sane kind of craziness there was another real craziness.
"Now admit it, Pete," he said. "Aren't there times when you'd like to see the whole damn town go up in flames? The whole thing knocked down and plowed over? It's a ghost town, man. The whole place is full of Rip Van Winkles. It's just one Rip Van Winkle after another. Bunch of weird Rip Van Winkles with vacuums for brains, with a knothead drunk for a sheriff, and crummy bars for a social life."
"What happened to Penny Drager?" Peter interrupted. "You haven't gone out with her for 3 weeks." Jim hunched over the bar and wrapped his hand around his beer glass.
"One, she heard I took that Mostyn dame out, so she got pissed off at me. Two, her parents, old Raleigh and Ermengarde, heard that she went out a couple of times with the late F. Robinson, so they grounded her.
She never told me about that, you know. Good thing she didn't. I would have grounded her all right."
"Do you think she went out with him because you took that woman to Humphrey's?"
"How the hell do I know why she does things, man? Do you see a sequence there, my boy?"
"Don't you?" It was sometimes safer to give Jim's questions back to him.
"Hell!"
He bent all the way forward, lay his shaggy head on the wet wood of the bar.
"All these women are mysteries to me."
He was speaking softly, as if regretfully, but Peter saw his eyes gleaming between his lashes and knew it was an act.
"Yeah, well, you might have a point. There might be a sequence there after all, Clarabelle. There just might be. And if there is, then that Anna dame, besides not giving me any herself after teasing me along, also screwed up the sex life I had. In fact, if you look at it that way, you could definitely say that she owes me a few."
He rolled his head a quarter turn up on the bar, and his eyes gleamed at Peter.
"Which had occurred to me, to tell you the truth."
He sat there, bent over, his head like a separate object on the bar, grinning maniacally up at Peter.
"Yes, it had, old pal."
Peter swallowed. Jim straightened up and knocked on the bar.
"Two more flagons here, sunshine."
"What do you want to do?" Peter asked, knowing that he would inevitably be carried along with it, and looked through the tavern's greasy windows at a pane of darkness flecked with white.
"Let's see, what do I want to do?" Jim mused.
And Peter realized, sickeningly, that Jim had known all along what he wanted to do, and that inviting him out for a beer was only the first moment of the plan. He'd been steered into this conversation as surely as he'd been driven out into the country, and all of it, another way of staying sane, and the ghost town business was enumerated on a list somewhere in Hardy's mind.
"What do I want to do?" He cocked his head. "Even this palace gets a little boring after a flagon or six. So, I guess going back to dear little Millburn would be pleasant. Yes, I think we'll definitely be going back to dear little Millburn."
"Let's stay away from her," Peter said. Jim ignored this.
You know, our dear lovely sexy friend moved out of the hotel 2 weeks ago.
Oh, she is missed. She is missed, Pete. I miss seeing that great ass going up the stairs. I miss those eyes flashing in the corridors. I miss her empty suitcase. I miss her amazing body. And I'm sure you know where she went.
My father arranged the mortgage. His house.
Peter nodded, more vigorously than he needed to, and realized he was getting drunk again.
Your old man's a useful old gnome, isn't he?
Jim asked, smiling pleasantly.
Innkeeper!
He banged on the bar.
Give my friend and myself a couple of shots of your best bourbon.
The bartender resentfully poured out shots of the same brand that Jim had stolen.
Now back to the point. Our friend, who is so sincerely missed, moves out of our excellent hotel and into Robinson's house. Now, isn't that a curious sort of coincidence? I suppose that you and I, Clarabelle, are the only two people in the world who know that it is a coincidence, because we're the only people who knew she was out at the station when old Freddy passed.
His heart, Peter muttered.
Oh, she does get you in the heart. She gets you by the heart and the balls.
But funny, though, isn't it? Freddy falls down onto the tracks.
Did I say falls?
No. Floats.
I saw it, remember?
He floats down onto the tracks like he's made out of tissue paper. Then she gets all hot to own his house. Is that also one old buddy? Do you see a sequence there, too, Clarabelle?
No, he whispered.
Now, Pete, that's not how you got early admission to Cornhole U. Use those powerful brain cells, baby.
He put his hand on Peter's back and leaned toward him, breathing the clear odor of alcohol into Peter's face.
Our sexy friend wants something in that house. Just think of her in there. Man, I'm curious, aren't you? That sexy lady moving around in Freddy's old house? What's she looking for? Money?
Jewelry? Dope? Well, who knows? But she's looking for something.
Moving that sexy frame of hers around those rooms, checking everything out.
That'd be a sight to see, wouldn't it?
I can't,
Peter said. The bourbon moved in his guts like oil.
I think, said Jim, that we will begin to move toward our transportation.
Peter found himself standing outside in the cold by Jim's car. He could not remember why he was alone. He stamped his feet, rotated his head on his shoulders, said,
Hey, Jim!
Hardy emerged a moment later, grinning like a shark.
Sorry to keep you waiting. Just had to tell our friend in there how much I enjoyed his company.
He didn't seem to believe me, so I had to repeat my message several times. He demonstrated what you could call a lack of interest. Fortunately, I managed also to take care of our liquid requirements for the remainder of this pleasant evening.
He partially unzipped his jacket and let the neck of a bottle protrude.
You're a madman.
I'm crazy like a fox, you mean?
Jim opened the car and leaned across the seat to unlock Peter's door.
Now to return to the subject of our previous discussion.
You really ought to go to college, Peter said as Jim started the car. With your talent for bull, you'd be Phi Beta Kappa.
Well, I used to think I'd be a pretty good lawyer, Jim said surprisingly. Here, have a jolt.
He passed Peter the bottle.
What's a good lawyer besides a superior bullshitter? Look at that old Sears James, man. If I ever saw a guy who looks like he could shit you from here to Key West.
Peter remembered his last sight of Sears James, seated massively in a car, his face pale behind the bleary window. Then he remembered the face of the boy sitting on the headstone in front of St. Michael's.
"Let's stay away from that woman," he said.
"Now, that's just the point I want to discuss."
He gave Peter a bright look.
"Didn't we reach the point where this mysterious lady is wandering around the house looking for something? As I recall, Clarabelle, I invited you to picture that."
Peter nodded miserably.
"And give me back that bottle if you're not going to do anything with it.
Now, there's something in that house, isn't there? Aren't you a little curious about what it is? There's something going on, anyhow, and you and me, old buddy, are the only people who know about it. Am I right so far?"
"You might be."
"Christ!"
Hardy yelled, making Peter jump.
"You dumb shit! What else can I be? There's some reason she wanted that house. That's the only thing that makes sense. There's something in there she wants."
"You think she got rid of Robinson?"
"I don't know about that. I didn't see anything but him sort of floating down onto the tracks. What the hell? But I can tell you one thing. I want to get a look at that house."
"Oh, no," Peter moaned.
"There's nothing to be afraid of," Jim protested. "She's just a broad, after all. She's got strange habits, but she's just a woman, Clarabelle. And for shit's sake, I'm not really stupid enough to go in there when she's there. And if you're too chicken shit to go in with me, you can walk from here."
Down, down the dark country road, down the dark road to Milburn.
"How will you know if she's out? She sits in the dark every night," she said.
"You ring the bell, dummy."
On the crest of the last low hill before the turnoff, Peter, already sick with worry, looked down the highway and saw the lights of Milburn. Gathered in a little depression in the land, they looked as though one hand could gather them up. It looked arbitrary, Milburn, like a nomad city of tents. And though Peter Barnes had known it all his life, though it was, in effect, all he had known, it looked unfamiliar. Then he saw why.
"Jim, look, all the lights on the west side of town are out. Snow pulls down the wires, but it's not snowing.
It snowed when we were in the bar."
"Did you really see a little kid sitting on top of the station that night?"
"Nah, just thought I did. It must have been snow or some newspaper or something." "Shit, Clarabelle, can a kid get up there? You know he can't." "Let's be straight, Clarabelle. It was a little spooky out there that night."
They continued on to Milburn, through the growing dark. 7. There in town, Don Wanderley sat at his desk on the west side of the Archer Hotel and saw darkness suddenly spread over the street below his window while his desk lamp still burned. And Ricky Hawthorne gasped as dark surged through his living room, and Stella said to get the candles. It was only that spot on the highway where the lines always blew down at least twice every winter. And Millie Sheehan, going for her own candles, heard a slow knocking at the front door, which she would never, ever, not in a thousand years, answer. And Sears James, locked in his suddenly dark library, heard a rattle of happy footsteps on his stairs and told himself he was dozing. And Clark Mulligan, who had been showing 2 weeks of science fiction and horror pictures and had a head full of lurid images,
"You can show it, man, but nobody makes you watch it,"
walked out of the Rialto for the fresh air in the middle of a reel and thought he saw in the sudden blackout a man who was a wolf lope across the street on a fierce errand, in an evil hurry to get somewhere.
"Nobody makes you watch the stuff, man."
Housebreaking, Part 2. 8. Jim stopped the car half a block away from the house.
"If only the goddamned lights didn't go off.
They were both looking at the building's blank facade, the curtainless windows behind which no figure moved, no candle shone. Peter Barnes thought of what Jim Hardy had seen. Freddie Robinson's body floating down onto the overgrown railway tracks, and of the little boy who wasn't there but perched on the tops of stations and headstones. And then he thought, I was right the last time. Fear sobers you up. When he looked at Jim, he saw him tense with excitement.
I thought she never turned them on, anyhow.
Man, I still wish they didn't go off, Jim said, and shivered, his face a grinning mask.
In a place like this, gesturing out at the respectable neighborhood of three-story houses,
you know, in a Rotarian pig heaven like this, our lady friend might sort of want to blend in. She might keep her lights on, just so nobody thinks there's nothing funny about her.
He tilted his head.
Like, you know, that old house on Haven Lane where that writer guy lived? Wanderley? You ever go past there at night? All these houses around here are all lit up, and there's old Wanderley's place, as dark as a tomb, man. Gives you the frights.
This gives me the frights, Peter admitted. Besides that, it's illegal.
You really are the pits, you know that?
Hardy turned on his seat and stared at Peter, who saw his barely controlled urge to get moving, to do, to flail out again at whatever obstacle the world had put in his way.
Do you get the feeling that our lady friend worries about what's legal and what isn't? Do you think she got that house because she was worried about the damn law, about Walt Hardesty, for Christ's sake?
Hardy shook his head, either disgusted or pretending to be disgusted. Peter suspected that he was working himself up for an action even he thought might be reckless. Jim turned away from him and started the car moving. Peter hoped for a moment that Hardy was going to circle around the block and go back to the hotel, but his friend kept the car in first gear and merely crept up the block until they were directly in front of the house.
You're either with me or you're a jerk, you jerk, he said. What are you going to do? First off, take a look in a downstairs window. Do you have balls enough for that, Clarabel? You won't be able to see anything. Jesus, Hardy said, and got out of the car.
Peter hesitated only a second. Then he too got out and followed Hardy up across the snowy lawn and around the side of the building. Both boys moved quickly, hunching over to avoid being seen by the neighbors. In a moment, they were sitting on their haunches in drifted snow beneath one of the side windows.
Well, at least you have guts enough to look in a window, Clarabel. Don't call me that, Peter whispered. I'm sick of that. Great time you picked to tell me.
Hardy grinned at him, then lifted his head to peer over the sill.
Hey, look at this.
Peter slowly raised his head above the sill. He was looking into a small side room, just visible in the moonlight falling in over their shoulders. The room had neither furniture nor carpet.
Weird lady, Hardy said,
and Peter heard laughter hidden in his voice.
Let's go around the back.
He scuttled away, still hunching over. Peter followed.
I'll tell you what, I don't think she's here, Hardy said, when Peter reached the back of the building.
He was standing up and leaning against the wall between a small window and the back door.
I just get the feeling this house is empty.
Here in the back, where no one could see them, both boys felt more comfortable. The long backyard ended in a white hillock of snow which was a buried hedge. A plaster birdbath, the basin covered with snow like frosting on a cake, sat between them and the hedge. Even by moonlight, this was a reassuringly commonplace object. You couldn't be frightened with a birdbath looking at you, Peter thought, and managed to smile.
Don't you believe me? Hardy challenged. It's not that.
Both were speaking in their normal voices,
Okay, you look in there first.
Okay. Peter turned and stepped boldly in front of the small window. He saw a sink, gleaming palely, a hardwood floor, a stove Mrs. Robinson must have left behind. A single water glass left on the breakfast bar caught an edge of moonlight. If the bird bath had looked homely, this looked forlorn. One glass gathering dust on the counter, and Peter at once began to agree with Jim that the house was empty.
"Nothing," he said.
Hardy nodded beside him. Then he jumped up to the small concrete step before the back door.
"Man, if you hear anything, run like hell."
He pushed the bell. The sound of the doorbell trilled through the house. Both boys braced themselves, held their breath. But no steps came, no voices called.
"Hey,"
Jim said, smiling seraphically at Peter.
"How about that?"
"We're doing this all wrong," Peter said. "What we ought to do is walk around in front and act like we just came. If anybody sees us, we'll just be two guys looking for her. If she doesn't answer the front doorbell, we'll do what people always do and look in the front windows. If someone sees us crawling around like we did before, they'll call the cops."
"Not bad," Jim said after a moment.
"Okay, we'll try it. But if nobody answers, I'm coming around back here and going in. That was the point, remember?" Peter nodded. He remembered. As if he too were relieved at having found a way to stop skulking, Jim walked freely and naturally to the front of the house. Peter coming more slowly behind him, Jim went across the lawn to the front door.
"Okay, sport," he said.
Peter stood beside him and thought, "I can't go in there." Empty but filled with bare rooms and the atmosphere of whatever kind of person chose to live in them, the house seemed to be feigning stillness. Jim rang the front bell.
"We're wasting time," he said, and betrayed his own unease. "Just wait. Just act normal."
Jim stuck his hands in the pockets of his jacket and fidgeted on the doorstep.
"Long enough. A few more seconds."
Jim exhaled a billowing cloud of steam.
"Okay, a few more seconds. 1, 2, 3. Now what?"
"Ring it again, just like you would if you thought she was at home." Jim stabbed the bell a second time. The trilling flared and died inside the house. Peter looked up and down the block of houses across the street. No cars, no lights. The dim glow of a candle shone in a window 4 houses away, but no curious faces looked out at the 2 boys standing on the steps of the new neighbor's house. Old Dr. Jaffrey's house directly across the street looked mournful. From nowhere at all, utterly inexplicably, distant music floated in the air. A buzzing trombone and insinuating saxophone. Jazz played a long way off.
"Huh?"
Jim Hardy lifted his head and turned from the door.
"Sounds like... what?"
Peter had an image of flatbed trucks, black musicians playing freely into the night.
"Sounds like a carnival."
"Sure, we get a lot of those in Milburn in November."
"Must be a record. Somebody's got his window open. Has to be."
And yet, as if the idea of carnival musicians suddenly appearing to play in Milburn was frightening, neither boy wanted to admit that these lilting sounds were too true to come from a record.
"Now we look in the window," Jim said. "Finally."
He jumped off the steps and went to the large front window. Peter stayed on the porch, softly clapping his hands together, listening to the fading music. The flatbed was going into the center of town, toward the square, he thought. But what sense did that make? The sound died away.
"You'll never guess what I'm looking at," Jim said.
Startled, Peter looked at his friend. Jim's face was determinedly bland.
An empty room.
Not quite.
He knew that Jim would not tell him. He would have to look for himself. Peter jumped off the step and walked up to the window. At first he saw what he had expected, a bare room where the carpet had been taken up and invisible dust lay everywhere. On the other side, the black arch of a doorway. On his side, the reflection of his own face looking out from the glass. He felt, for a second, the terror of being trapped in there like his reflection, of being forced to go through that doorway, to walk the bare floorboards. The terror made no more sense than the band music, but like it, it was there. Then he saw what Jim had meant. On one side, up against the baseboards, a brown suitcase lay on the floor.
"That's hers," Jim said in his ear.
"You know what that means?"
"She's still there. She's in there."
"No! Whatever she wanted is still in there."
Peter backed away from the window and looked at Jim's set, red face.
"That's enough screwing around," Jim said. "I'm going inside. You coming, Clara Bell?"
Peter could not answer. Jim simply stepped around him and set off around the side of the house. Seconds later, he heard the pop and tinkle of breaking glass. He groaned, turned around, and saw his features reproduced in the window. They were pulled by fear and indecision. "Get out." "No, you have to help him."
"Get out."
"No, you have to." He went around the side of the house as quickly as he could without running. Jim was up on the back steps, reaching in through the little pane of glass he had broken. In the dim light, bent over, he was the image of a burglar. Jim's words came back to him.
"So the worst has already happened, and you might as well relax and enjoy it." "Oh, it's you," Jim said. "Thought you'd be home under the bed by now."
"What happens if she comes home?"
"We run out the back, idiot. 2 doors in this house, remember? Or don't you think you can run as fast as a woman?"
His face stilled with concentration for a moment. Then the lock clicked open.
"Coming?"
"Maybe. But I'm not going to steal anything, and you aren't either." Jim snorted derisively and went through the door. Peter went up the steps and peered in. Hardy was moving across the kitchen floor, going deeper into the house, not bothering to look back.
"Might as well relax and enjoy it."
He stepped over the doorframe. Ahead of him, Hardy was thumping around in the hallway, opening doors and cabinets.
"Quiet,"
Peter hissed.
"Quiet yourself," Jim called back.
But the noises immediately ceased, and Peter understood that, whether or not he admitted it, Jim also was afraid.
"Where do you want to look?" Peter asked. "What are we looking for, anyway?"
"How should I know? We'll know when we see it."
"It's too dark in here to see anything. You could see better from the outside."
Jim pulled his matches out of his jacket and lit one.
"How's that?"
In truth, it was worse. Where they previously had a dim vision of the entire hallway, now they could only see within a small circle of light.
"Okay, but we stick together," Peter said.
"We could cover the house faster if we split up."
"No way,"
Jim shrugged.
"Whatever you want."
He led Peter down the hall into the living room. This was even bleaker than they had been able to see from the outside. The walls, dotted here and there by children's crayons, also showed the pale rectangles where pictures had hung. Paint flaked off in chips and patches. Jim was going around the room, knocking on the walls, lighting one match after another.
"Look at the suitcase."
"Oh, yeah, the suitcase."
Jim knelt down and opened the case.
"Nothing."
Peter watched over his shoulder as Jim turned the suitcase over, shook it, and replaced it on the bare floor. He whispered,
"We're not going to find anything."
Christ, we look in two rooms, and you're ready to give up.
Jim stood up abruptly, and his match went out. For a moment, pure blackness enveloped them.
Light another one, Peter whispered. Better this way. No one outside can see a light. Your eyes will adjust.
They stood in silence and darkness for 5 or 6 seconds, letting the image of flame fade from their eyes, become a pinpoint in sheer black, then waited longer seconds while the features of the house took shape around them. Peter heard a noise from somewhere in the house and jumped.
For God's sake, calm down. What was that?
Peter whispered, and heard the hysteria rising in his voice.
A stair creaked, the back door clicked shut, nothing.
Peter touched his forehead with his fingers and felt them trembling against his skin.
Listen, we've been talking, pounding walls. We broke a window. Don't you think she'd come out if she was here? I guess so. Okay, let's try the next floor.
Jim grabbed the sleeve of his jacket and pulled him out of the living room back into the hall. Then he let go and led Peter down the hall to the foot of the stairs. Up there it was dark. Up there it was new territory. Peter felt more profoundly uneasy looking at the stairs than he had since entering the house.
You go up and I'll stay here. You want to hang around in the dark by yourself?
Peter tried to swallow, but could not. He shook his head.
All right. It's got to be up there, whatever it is.
Jim put his foot on the second of the unpainted steps. Here, too, the carpet had been removed. He lifted himself up, looked back.
Coming?
Then he began to mount the stairs, taking them by twos. Peter watched. When Jim was halfway up, he willed himself to follow. The lights snapped on again when Jim was at the top, and Peter was two-thirds of the way up.
"Hello, boys," said a deep, unruffled voice from the bottom of the stairs. Jim Hardy shrieked. Peter fell backward on the stairs, and, half-paralyzed with fright, thought he'd slide right down into the grasp of the man looking up at them.
"Let me take you to your hostess," he said, giving them a dead smile. He was the strangest-looking man Peter had ever seen. A blue-knit cap was shoved down over blonde curly hair like Harpo Marx's. Sunglasses rode on his nose. He wore overalls but no shirt, and his face was white as ivory. It was the man from the square.
"She will be delighted to see you again," the man said. "As her first visitors, you can count on an especially warm welcome."
The man's smile broadened as he began to come up the stairs after them. When he had come up only a few of the steps, he lifted a hand and pulled the blue cap off his head. The Harpo curls, a wig, came off with it. When he took off the dark glasses, his eyes shone a uniform golden yellow.
9. Standing at his window in the hotel and looking out over the darkened section of Milburn, Don heard the far-off convolutions of saxophones and trombones blaring on the cold air and thought, "Dr. Rabbitfoot's come to town." His telephone rang behind him. Sears was facing his library door, listening for footsteps padding on his stairs, when his telephone rang. Ignoring it, he unlocked his door, opened it. The staircase was empty. He went to answer his phone. Louis Benedict, whose mansion was on the furthest periphery of the area affected by the power failure, heard neither music nor childish footsteps. What he heard, blown on the wind or from inside his own mind, or drifting on a draft through his dining room and winding around a newel post on its way toward him, was the most despairing sound he knew, the languishing, nearly inaudible voice of his dead wife, calling over and over again,
"Louis! Louis!"
He had been hearing it on and off for days. When his telephone rang, he turned to it with relief. And with relief, too, heard Ricky Hawthorne's voice.
"I'm going batty, sitting here in the dark. I've spoken to Sears and Edward's nephew, and Sears graciously said that we can get together at this short notice at his house. I'd say we need to. Do you agree? We'll break a rule and just come as we are, shall we?"
Ricky thought that the young man was getting to look like a true member of the Chowder Society. Beneath the mask of sociability anyone would expect from a nephew of Edward's, he had the Jim Jams. He leaned back in one of Sears's wonderful leather chairs. He sipped his whiskey and looked, with his uncle's reflex amusement, around the cherished interior of the library. Did it look as old-fashioned to him as Edward had said it was? He spoke at intervals, but there was an undercurrent of tension in all of it. "Maybe that makes him one of us," Ricky thought. And he saw that Don was the sort of person they would have befriended years and years back. If he had been born 40 years earlier, he would have been one of them as if by birthright. Still, there was a streak of secrecy in him. Ricky could not imagine what he had meant by asking if any of them had heard music during the early evening. Pressed about this, he had evaded explanations. Pressed further, he had said, "I was just getting the feeling that everything happening has a direct relationship to my writing." This remark, which would have seemed egotistical at any other time, was given density by the candlelight. Each of the men stirred in his chair. "Isn't that why we asked you here?" Sears said. And then he had explained. Ricky listened, puzzled, to Don's account of his idea for a new book and the description of the Dr. Rabbitfoot character, and how he had heard the showman's music just before Ricky's call.
"Are you saying that events in this town are occurrences from an unwritten book?" Sears asked incredulously. "That's sheer poppycock."
"Unless," Ricky said, thinking, "unless, well, I'm not really sure how to put this, unless things here in Millburn have focused lately, have come to a focus they did not have before."
"You mean that I'm the focus?" Don said.
"I don't know."
"This is nonsense," Sears interjected. "Focused, unfocused. All that's happened is that we are managing to frighten ourselves even more. That's your focus. The daydreams of a novelist can't have anything to do with it."
Louis sat apart from all this, wrapped in some private misery. Ricky asked him what he thought, and Louis replied,
"Sorry, I was thinking about something else. Can I get myself another drink, Sears?"
Sears nodded grimly. Louis was drinking at twice his normal rate, as if his appearance at a meeting in an old shirt and tweed jacket gave him license to break another of their old rules.
"What's supposed to indicate this mysterious focus?" Sears asked belligerently.
"You know as well as I do. John's death, first of all."
"Coincidence," Sears said.
"Elmer's sheep, all the animals that have died."
"Now you believe in Hardesty's Martians."
"Don't you remember what Hardesty told us? That it was sort of a game, an amusement some sort of creature gave itself. What I'm suggesting is that the stakes have been raised. Freddie Robinson, poor old Rhea Dedham. I felt months ago that our stories were bringing something about, and I fear, I very much fear, that more people are going to die.
I'm saying that our lives and the lives of many people in this town may be endangered.
Well, what I said stands. You have certainly managed to frighten yourself, Sears said.
We're all frightened, Ricky pointed out.
His cold made his voice raw and his throat throbbed, but he forced himself to go on.
We are. But what I think is that Don's arrival here was like the fitting of the last piece into a puzzle. That when all of us were joined by Don, the forces, whatever you want to call them, were increased. That we invoked them. We, by our stories, Don, in his book and in his imagination, we see things, but we don't believe them. We feel things, people watching us, sinister things following us, but we dismiss them as fantasies. We dream horrors, but try to forget them. And in the meantime, three people have died.
Lewis stared at the rug, then nervously spun an ashtray on the table before his chair.
I just remembered something I said to Freddie Robinson on the night he cornered me outside John's house. I said that someone was picking us off like flies.
But why should this young man, whom none of us had seen until a short time ago, be the last element? Sears asked.
Because he was Edward's nephew?
Ricky asked. It came to him straight from the blue sky of inspiration. A moment later, he felt a painful spasm of relief that his children were not coming to Millburn for Christmas.
Yes, because he is Edward's nephew.
All three of the older men almost palpably felt the gravity of what Ricky had called the forces about them. Three frightened men, they sat in the molten light of the candles and looked back into their past.
Maybe, Lewis at last said. He drained his whiskey.
But I don't understand about Freddie Robinson. He wanted to meet with me. He called me twice. I just put him off.
Made a vague promise to see him in a bar sometime, Sears asked.
He had something to tell you before he died?
I didn't give him the chance to tell it. I thought he wanted to sell me insurance.
Why did you think that?
Because he said something about trouble coming your way.
They were silent again.
Maybe, Lewis said. If I met him, he'd still be alive, Ricky said.
Lewis, that sounded just like John Jaffrey. He blamed himself for Edward's death.
For a moment, all three men glanced at Don Wanderley.
Maybe I'm not here just because of my uncle, Don said. I want to buy my way into the Chowder Society.
What?
Sears exploded.
Buy?
With a story. Isn't that the admission fee?
He smiled tentatively around the circle.
It's very clear in my mind because I just spent some time writing it all in a journal.
And, he said, breaking another of their rules, this isn't fiction. This happened just in the way I'll tell it. You couldn't use it as fiction because it didn't have a real ending. It just slipped backward when other things happened.
But if Mr. Hawthorne,
Ricky,
the lawyer breathed,
is right, then five people, not four, have died, and my brother was the first of them.
You were both engaged to the same girl,
Ricky said, remembering one of the last things Edward had said to him.
We were both engaged to Alma Mobley, a girl I met at Berkeley, Don began.
And the four of them settled into their chairs.
I think this is a ghost story, he said, pulling, in Dr. Rabbitfoot's image, the dollar from his jeans.
He held them with a story, speaking into the flame of the candles, as if into an unquiet place in his mind. He did not tell it as he had in his journal, deliberately invoking all the detail he could remember, but he told most of it. The story took him half an hour. So, the Who's Who entry proved that everything she had said was false, Don concluded. David was dead, and I never saw her again. She had simply disappeared. He wiped his face, exhaled loudly. That's it. Is it a ghost story or not? You tell me. None of the men spoke for a moment. Tell him, Sears, Ricky silently prayed. He looked over at his old friend, who had steepled his fingers before his face. Say it, Sears. Tell him. Sears' eyes met his. He knows what I'm thinking. Well, Sears said, and Ricky closed his eyes. As much as any of our stories is, I guess. Is that the series of events on which you based your book? Yes. They make a better story than the book, Sears said. But they don't have an ending. Not yet, perhaps, Sears said. He scowled at the candles which had burned down into the silver holders.
Now,
Ricky prayed, his eyes still closed. This young man you imagined to look like a werewolf was named, Greg? Greg Benton? Ricky opened his eyes again, and if anyone had been looking at him, they would have seen gratitude written on his every feature. Don nodded, clearly not understanding why this was important. I knew him under a different name, Sears said. A long time ago, he was called Gregory Bate, and his half-witted brother was called Fenny. I was present when Fenny died. He smiled with the bitterness of a man compelled to eat a meal he hates. That would have been quite some time before your Benton decided to affect a shaven head.
If he could make two appearances, then he can make three, Ricky said. I saw him on the square not 2 weeks ago.
The lights, violently bright after so long a time of candlelight, came suddenly on. The four men in Sears's library, their distinction, and whatever of ease the candlelight had given them, erased by the harsher light, looked fearful.
We look half dead already, Ricky thought.
It was as though the candles had drawn them into a warm circle, the warmth of a candle and a group and a story. Now they were blown apart, scattered on a wintry plain.
Looks like he heard you, Lewis, drunk, said. Maybe that's what Freddy Robinson saw. Maybe he saw Gregory turning into a wolf. Ha!
Housebreaking Part 3 10. Peter picked himself up on the stairs and, with no awareness of willing himself to move, went backward up the stairs to stand beside Jim on the landing. The werewolf came slowly, unstoppably, toward them, in no hurry at all.
You want to meet her, don't you?
His grin was ferocious.
She will be so pleased. You will have quite a welcome, I promise you.
Peter looked wildly about, saw phosphorescent light leaking from beneath a door.
She is not perhaps quite in shape to see you yet, but that makes it all the more interesting, don't you think? We all like to see our friends with their masks off.
He's talking to keep us still, Peter thought. It's like hypnotism.
Aren't you the two boys interested in scientific exploration? In telescopes?
How nice it is to meet two fine young fellows with inquiring minds, two fellows who want to extend their knowledge.
So many young people merely coast along, don't they? So many are afraid to take risks.
Well, we certainly can't say that about you now, can we?
Peter glanced at Jim Hardy's face. Jim's mouth hung open.
No, you have been extremely brave. Now I will be with you in a moment, and I want you to relax and wait for me. Just relax and wait.
Peter slammed the back of his hand into Jim's ribs, but Jim did not move. He glanced back at the terrible figure coming toward him and made the mistake of looking directly into the blank, golden eyes. Immediately he heard a voice like music coming not from the man, but speaking directly inside his head.
Relax, Peter. Relax. You will meet her.
Jim! He screamed. Hardy gave a convulsive shudder, and Peter knew that he was lost already.
Settle down, boy. No need for all that noise.
The golden-eyed man was nearly to them, reaching out his left hand. Peter stepped backward, too frightened for coherent thought. The man's white hand glided nearer and nearer Jim's own left hand. Peter turned his back and pounded halfway up the next flight of stairs. When he looked around, the light beneath the door on the landing was spilling out with such intensity that the walls were tinted faintly green. Green, too, was Jim in that light.
Just take my hand, the man said.
He was two steps below Jim, and their hands nearly touched. Jim brushed his fingers against the palm of the man's hand. Peter looked up the stairs but could not leave Jim. The man beneath was chuckling. Peter's heart froze, and he looked down again. The man was grasping Jim's wrist with his left hand. The wolfish eyes glowed wide. Jim screeched. The man holding him moved his hands to Jim's throat and twisted his body with immense force, slamming the boy's head against the wall. He planted his feet on the boards of the landing and again smashed Jim's head into the wall.
Your turn.
Jim fell onto the boards, and the man kicked him aside as if he were as weightless as a paper bag. A bright smear of blood, like a child's finger painting, lay on the wall. Peter ran down a long corridor lined with doors, opened one at random, and slipped in. Just inside the door, he froze. The outline of a man's head showed against a window.
Welcome home, the man's toneless voice said. Have you met her yet?
He stood up from the bed.
You haven't. Once you do, you'll never forget it. An incredible woman.
The man, still only a black outline against a window, began to shuffle toward Peter, who remained stock still just inside the door. As the man drew nearer, he saw that it was Freddie Robinson.
Welcome home, Robinson said. Found you.
Footsteps in the corridor paused outside the bedroom door.
Time, 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 time. You know, I don't exactly remember.
Panicked, Peter rushed at Robinson with his arms extended, intending to shove him out of the way. The moment his fingers touched his shirt, Robinson broke up into a shapeless pattern of glowing points of light. His fingers tingled. It was gone, utterly, in an instant, and Peter rushed through the air where it had been.
Come out, Peter, said the voice outside the door. We all want you to come out.
And the other voice in his mind repeated,
Time.
Standing in front of the bed, Peter heard the doorknob moving. He scrambled onto the bed and banged the heels of his hands against the top of the window frames. The window slid up as if on grease. Cold air streamed over him. He felt the other mind reaching for him, telling him to come to the door, not to be silly. Didn't he want to see that Jim was all right?
Jim!
He crawled out of the window as the door opened. Something rushed toward him, but he was already across the upper roof and jumped down onto the next level. From there, he let himself drop onto the roof of the garage, and from the garage he jumped onto a snowdrift. As he ran past Jim's car, he looked sideways at the house. But it was as solidly ordinary as it had looked at first. Only the lights in the stairwell and front hall burned, casting an inviting rectangle of yellow onto the walk. That, too, seemed to speak to Peter Barnes, to say,
"Imagine the peace of lying down with your hands crossed on your chest. Imagine sleeping under ice."
He ran all the way home. 11.
"Lewis, you're already drunk," Sears said gruffly. "Don't make more of an ass of yourself."
"Sears," Lewis said, "it's a funny thing, but it's hard not to make an ass of yourself when you talk about stuff like this."
"That's a point. But for God's sake, stop drinking."
"You know, Sears," Lewis said, "I get the feeling our little decorums aren't going to be much good anymore."
Ricky asked him,
"Do you want to stop meeting?"
"Well, what the hell are we, the Three Musketeers?"
"In a way, we're what's left. Plus Don, of course."
"Oh, Ricky," Lewis smiled. "The sweetest thing about you is that you're so damned loyal."
"Only to the things worth being loyal to,"
Ricky said, and sneezed loudly twice.
Excuse me. I ought to be home. Do you really want to give up the meetings?"
Lewis shoved his glass toward the middle of the table and slumped down in his chair.
"I don't know. I suppose not. I'd never get any of Sears's good cigars if we didn't meet twice a month. And now that we have a new member, well..."
Just as Sears was about to burst out, Lewis looked up at them and was handsome as he'd ever been in his life.
"And maybe I'd be scared not to meet. Maybe I believe everything you said, Ricky. I've had a couple of funny experiences since October. Since the night Sears talked about Gregory Bate."
"So have I," Sears said.
"So have I,"
echoed Ricky.
"Isn't that what we've been saying?"
"So I guess we should tough it out," Lewis said. "You guys are in another league intellectually from me. Maybe this kid here is too. But I guess it's a hang together or hang separately kind of situation. Sometimes, out at my place, I get really spooked. Like something is out there just counting the seconds until it can nail me. Like it nailed John."
"Do we believe in werewolves?" Ricky asked.
"No," Sears said, and Lewis shook his head.
"I don't either," said Don. "But there's something..."
He paused, thinking, and looked up to see all three of the older men looking expectantly at him.
"I don't have it worked out yet. It's just an idea. I'll think about it some more before I try to explain it."
"Well, the lights have been on for some time now," Sears said pointedly. "And we had a good story. Perhaps we've made some progress, but I don't see how. If the Bate brothers are in Milburn, I'd like to assume that they'll do as the ineffable Hardesty suggests and move on when they're tired of us."
Don read the expression in Ricky's eyes and nodded.
"Wait," Ricky said. "Excuse me, Sears, but I sent Don out to see Nettie Dedham at the hospital."
"Oh, yes?"
Sears was already